from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome to this week. Well, this week we investigate some tall stories in a short time frame. We look at the myth and the mystery once again. No Edgar Allan Poe this week, as in prior Christmas, but with Wheels magazine, Old Wives' Tales, and the politically correct meaning, fibs. The truth will out in 30 laps. We'll go all out and right the wrongs, or at least give you the full drum, the whole nine yards, the bee's knees, the full tilt. We'll stop the sabre rattling, keep your hair on, stop the rag being lost, and impede the umbrella approach. Ha! Just as an aside, when it was invented, it was just called Brella. But the guy, or the inventor, who invented it, stumbled just at the wrong moment, and hence, umbrella. Right at this point of the speech, it's a true story, as are all the stories today on 30 Laps. And we knew all along about these blokes, so stay tuned and find out what that's all about. And another thing, or finger to be precise, a gold one, the world's most famous DB5. We've got all the MIs this week, MI5, 6, 4, 3, 2, 1, on 30 laps. So, tall stories, the myths and the mysteries, those blokes and those German cars, and the name is Martin, Aston Martin. So, let's get cracking, shall we? From Wheels magazine, it's an article by Andy Enright, written in February 2020. So let's find out what this is all about, hey? Japanese motoring, it seems, is a rich breeding ground for enduring myths. Some of them have been long buried in origin. In fact, while others are just pure poppycock. We take a look at some of the more prevalent beliefs and rate them according to their veracity. Sounds good. Let's go. First one is, you still need to run your car in. This is one your dad probably warned you about. New cars have a running in process during the first couple of weeks of ownership, and should you fail to adhere to it, and you risk reducing the lifespan of your car's power plant, or worse. This usually involves gentle acceleration, staying below certain RPM, progressively introducing load and avoiding towing. Some new car manuals recommend it, others don't. And have been how new cars are unloaded onto and off transporters at dockyards. They're generally not babied. I can vouch for that. We spoke to an ex-Honda boss who noted that they had to ask the factory to chock the front springs of the S2000s because they were given being driven out of transporters so fast the front spoilers were being damaged. We spoke to a pair of mechanics who work at a new car dealership for brands from both the mainstream and high-performance luxury ends of the spectrum. For mainstream marks, it's unsurprising that little attention is required from new owners post-delivery. Our contact said he was not aware of any official running-in process. New owners simply pick up the keys and drive away. Provided you're sensible and the car initially and the service schedule is adhered to, all will be well. Toyota claims customers taking delivery of new Corolla will see the car unlikely to require any change of a person's normal driving style. Mazda similarly said that no special running-in was necessary. Hyundai said no special break-in was required. So, if you don't believe us, try the biggest selling marks in Australia. Verdict? Myth. Up to a point. Number two. Japanese cars are still most reliable. Again, this is a belief that needs addressing. Hard, comparable reliability data is almost impossible to come by, as cars tend to be driven very differently across marks. The JD Power survey is still perhaps the most accurate way of testing how well screwed together your car is. It measures the number of faults owners report during the first 90 days of ownership. True, Lexus was the most reliable brand in the 2019 survey, but we took the data and crunched it to derive the average number of faults according to country. The best performing nation was Germany, with an average of 123.8 faults per 100 cars. Following close behind was South Korea with 125, and then the Japanese on 138.8. American cars registered 151.5 faults, British models 169.3, Swedish cars 204, and Italian cars 249 problems per 100 cars. Now, those numbers do need to be qualified. They're a broad brush average. That, for instance, counts Volkswagen as a German brand, despite the fact that it manufactures its cars in 21 countries around the world, with the bulk of its product emanating outside of Germany. But you get the point. If you simply rely on Japanese badge as your guarantee of quality, you could be in it for a nasty surprise. Verdict? Myth. Number three, taking your car on track voids your warranty. Talk about a can of worms. In theory, driving your car at a track day shouldn't necessarily compromise your new car warranty. If the car isn't modified, it's maintained correctly, and it's driven within its mechanical limits, your warranty shouldn't be voided by participating in a track day. But there is a difference between warranty being voided and one where the manufacturer won't cover faults that arise on track. Any form of competitive driving, like Time-A-Track, Autocross, etc., won't be covered by any new car warranty. General track day driving is a different matter. Hyundai, for instance, offers a track day warranty for its one i30N model. This means stress-free track excursions for the full length of the Hyundai's standard 5-year unlimited kilometre warranty, as long as the events entered are non-competitive. Hyundai doesn't even mind if you fit sticker track day tyres, apart from the standard Pirelli P0s. Just don't assume that because you have a track-orientated car that the manufacturer will cover any sort of mechanical glitch that occurs on the circuit. Many people buy a Porsche 911 GT3 specifically for this, its penchant of absorbing flat-out circuit sessions. But look a little deeper into the nether regions of its owner's handbook and you'll spot this gem. In the owner's manual, it says in very small print, several pages in, under certain circumstances and under track experience, your warranty may be voided if there is a problem with performance consideration. So, folks, the verdict there is... it varies. Yes, it varies. And you can be rest assured that if you are in a Porsche GT3 and you have some sort of mechanical problem and you take it to a Porsche GT3 dealer, you won't have that taste of honey in your mouth for long. Still, if you don't like paying service costs and you don't like paying fuel costs, the GT3 Porsche is probably not for you. But back to our survey. You'll get better fuel economy if you use 98 RON rather than ultra-premium petrol. For most of the people, most of the time, running their car on 98 RON or almost super will have no appreciable benefit in terms of economy. If your car is engineered to run on 91 or 95, and that's what it says on the filler cap, then use that fuel. You'd just be wasting your mother money, upsetting your mother and wasting your money otherwise. The compression ratio of your engine is geared to the combustion properties of that particular fuel, and using a high octane fuel won't offer economy benefits. When 98 RON fuel does offer a benefit is if you own a very high performance vehicle that stipulates that this fuel is required to avoid pre-detonation of the fuel, or in our language, NOC. Refer previous vehicle, the Porsche GT3. Verdict, myth. Here's a beauty, I like this one. You'll reduce fuel consumption in your ute if you fold the tailgate down. It would seem to stand to reason that smoothing the airflow at the back of your ute would make it more aerodynamic and, by logical extension, more fuel efficient. Somewhat counterintuitively, driving with the tailgate up is more efficient than folding it down. Why? When the tailgate on your ute is closed, it helps to create a high-pressure bubble of air in the cargo tray, named, or known even, as the separated bubble effect. Air flowing across the roof of the ute is deflected by this bubble of air and is gently guided over the tailgate, separating a long way behind the ute into vortices. Drop the tailgate and you lose this bubble. A low pressure sucking of the air to the bed of the truck, creating drag in the tray and onto the wheel arches, and affixing these wasteful vortices to the rear of the vehicle. The difference tends to be mounted and around 8% in terms of fuel efficiency. This gets even worse if you use an aftermarket rather than a normal factory tailgate. General Motors aerodynamics team discovered that fuel economy could be improved by fitting a soft tourniquet instead of a hard lid, as this helps the shape of the airflow over the back of the track, in effect creating a spoiler at the rear. Verdict? Myth. This is Richard Lyon. You're with 30 Laps with Dick, and we're talking about old wives' tales in motoring. And we're 13 minutes into our journey today. Two cars travelling at 50 kilometres an hour crashing into one another head-on is the same as one car hitting a wall at 100 kilometres an hour. Physics is your friend here, unless you're the one driving into the wall at 100 kilometres an hour, and it's certainly not. Two cars approaching each other at 50 kilometres an hour each have a closing speed of 100 kilometres an hour, but neither possesses the kinetic energy of one car travelling at 100 kilometres an hour. So, against all initial logic, the two cars driving head-on into one another have the same kinetic energy as one driving into a wall at 50 kilometres an hour. The only difference in practical terms is that the car coming the other way has a deformable crash structure, and walls don't tend to be built with that in mind. Verdict, myth. But please, don't try this at home. Letting your car run low on fuel drags the residue out of the bottom of the tank of your engine. Now, what do you think a fuel filter does? And where do you think your fuel pickup sits in the tank? It's at the top, not the bottom. Move on, nothing to see here. Verdict, a myth. Windscreens will crack if you pour hot water on them. Every winter, without fail, there's a thread on here. This old chestnut has legs. It began in the days where most windscreens were made of toughened or tempered glass. Pouring hot water on these screens would thermally shock them and cause them to shatter. Modern cars have laminated windscreens with a sheet of polyvinyl butyl between two and three pieces of glass. These have a far greater temperature latitude and will not shotter or shatter, for that matter, when hot water is poured on them. If, however, you have a stone chip in the screen, hot water will seep into the crack and then refreeze later, causing a crack. So while you theoretically can, it's better to clear ice with cold water, or better still, a can of de-icer, a heated windscreen, or your car's heater vents. And yes, cold water takes longer to freeze than tepid water. Again, sounds utterly counterintuitive, but Google the Meba effect. Verdict? Myth. But don't try it. Your mobile phone can cause an explosion while you're refilling your car. Plenty of people tend to ignore this rule. Much as plenty of people are singularly unconvinced that their mobile phone will bring down a passenger jet. Thing is, if it has a battery in it and it's a potential ignition source, just ask Samsung Galaxy Note 7 users. As for your mobile phone, well, no, not really. Robert Rinkes, a spokesman for the American Petroleum Institute, said, "We have not found a cell phone responsible for any fire since the beginning of mankind." I didn't know they had mobile phones in the beginning of mankind. Anyway, Mythbusters, the popular TV show, even tried to provoke an explosion by placing a cell phone in a chamber packed with petrol vapour and couldn't manage it. Practically speaking, the electric field created by your phone, the typically 2 to 5 volt per meter, is too small to create a viable explosion on a forecourt. In the UK, both Texaco and Shell petrol stations have often had mobile phone masts secreted inside their fuel price towers, a handful of meters from the pumps, and those things pump out a heck of a lot more power than your measly handset. Some industries, such as oil refineries, nevertheless take a belt and braces approach and insist that employees in high explosive risk areas use what is called the ATEX rated handset, and that's sealed and runs lower power with a lower power draw and operating systems and such like. The bigger problem is a phone is your clothing. The vast majority of petrol station fires are caused by static electricity. And if you're sliding across those synthetic seats, wearing synthetic fibres, you could easily build up enough charge to create a viable spark. Should the earthing wire in your car be broken and you're insulated by rubber-soled shoes, touching the nozzle of the hose to the neck of the fuel filter could create a sizable spark. But your phone? No. It's never been done. Verdict? Myth. This is a beauty, this one. I've heard this one before, but it's a good story. The Mitsubishi Starion was so called because executives at Mitsubishi were trying to call it a stallion and something was lost in translation. Casual racism or a genuine mistake? The story goes that in order to rival the Mustang, Mitsubishi came up with a sports coupe that was going to be called the Stallion. But pronunciation difficulties between Japan and a European marketing agency scuppered the execution. Proponents of the story even point to the equine theme in Mitsubishi's naming policy with their Evergreen, Colt, Canter and Lancer nameplates. They also use the Mitsubishi's Pajero badge, which is a crude term for a gentleman pleasuring himself in Spanish, as evidence that even Mitsubishi marketing can get the nomenclature catastrophically even. The company's own explanation is that it's shortening of Star and Orion, which sounds even weirder, but given that the other sporting cars launched on the same point in the early 80s were the oddly named Cordia and Tredia, there's no reason to doubt them. Add to that the fact that Mitsubishi have a long and traditional name of naming their engines after astronomy and mythical scenes, Astron, Neptune, Saturn, Sirius, Vulcan, etc. And we're prepared to give the Starion the benefit of the doubt. However, if you do say stallion with a bit of a Japanese tilt, it does come out like Starion. But that's a story for another day. So, verdict on that is likely myth. You'll never get booked for speeding if you're less than 10% over the posted speed limit. If you still believe this and have never been booked for speeding, count yourself extremely lucky, especially if you live in Victoria. As a professional road tester, I've heard some colleagues claim you'll be safe from getting pinged if your speed is within 10% of the limit. So 88 kilometres per hour in an 80 zone is fine, as is 121 on a 110 kilometre highway. Having been sent speed camera fines for 4 kilometres over the unit limit, the tolerances for fines can be extremely low in Victoria. New South Wales has less of a reputation for draconian speed enforcement than the Garden State. Draconian. Like something out of Star Wars. And we notice that our colleagues from the Sydney office tend to spend less time inspecting their speedos and more time observing the road ahead. Police forces are genuinely reluctant to publish threshold speeds for ticketing, as this then creates a new de facto speed limit. South Australia's police did admit in 2017 that some motorists were able to go past speed cameras travelling as much as 7 kilometres over the limit without getting fined. But the threshold wasn't in any way uniform. In other zones, 1 kilometre an hour would result in a fine. As part of the wheels performance testing procedure, we measure the vehicle speedometers for accuracy. For instance, a Kia Picanto might read 100 kilometres an hour when it is in fact travelling at 95, and whereas a Mazda CX-8 will be dead on the money at the tonne. So it's best not to rely on an element of speedo error in a car that hasn't been accurately verified. As an aside, we're yet to find a car that underreports its speed. So, verdict, another myth. And that's where we leave our myth and mystery for the day. I think that's quite enough old wives' tales. We've got enough to fill a rowing boat there. What's this all about? The study reveals luxury European car drivers are more likely to be jerks. Well, I couldn't resist this one. It comes from driven.co.nz. European research has confirmed what many people have suspected. Men who drive luxury cars are more likely to be jerks. Jan-Erik Lundqvist, professor of social psychology at the University of Helsinki, started work to understand luxury car buyers after observing antisocial behaviour in traffic. Haven't we all? I had noticed that the ones most likely to run a red light, not give way to pedestrians, and generally drive recklessly and too fast were often the ones driving fast German cars, he said. Lundqvist's team surveyed nearly 1,900 drivers, asking them about their time and car preferences, their wealth, their personality traits, and other social factors. They reported that self-centred men who are argumentative, stubborn, disagreeable, and unempathetic are more likely to own a high-status car such as an Audi and a BMW or Mercedes. As Lundqvist puts it, those who personality are deemed more disagreeable were drawn to the high-status cars. These personality traits explain the desire to own a high-status product, and the same traits also explain why such people break traffic regulations more frequently than others, he says. But we found that those whose personality was deemed more disagreeable were more drawn to high-status cars. Those people often find themselves as superior and are keen to display this to others. Researchers found that the link between antisocial personality traits and an attraction to luxury cars was only found in men. Now there's a surprise. Not women. The team discovered a second type of person was attracted to high-end cars, conscientious men and women often described as respectable, ambitious, reliable and well organised. The link is presumably explained by the importance they attach to high quality, Longquist says. All makes of a car have specific image, and by driving a reliable car, they are sending out the message that they themselves are reliable. It would be great if consumers had other sustainable ways of showing their status, rather than the superficial consumption of luxury goods that often has a negative consequence. We are already seeing that driving an electric car is becoming something of a status symbol, whereas SUVs and their high emissions are no longer considered cool. Don't you love that? It's a great little piece from news.co.nz, and it was an editorial, so Anonymous was responsible. So my name is Martin, Aston Martin, the original DB5. We will have to save that for next week. We appear to have run out of time. So we need to run to fit it all in and get us to the church on time. Thank you, Mr. Andre Previn. So we move back to Dexter Gordon to take us out. I hope you've enjoyed this week's little episode about myth and mystery from Cars Magazine. And you might now know the truth about some of the popular misconceptions in our motoring world. And of course, the lovely little piece from driven.co.nz about fast, cranky men and German cars. We knew it all along, didn't we, hey? Thank you very much for your company today. I've enjoyed bringing you the show, and I look forward to spending some time with you next week. If you've got half an hour, I certainly have got a good way to spend it. The show's written and produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH. I'm Richard Lyon, and thank you very much for joining me. We'll be right back.